Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy and Tiny Dancer. He gone.
Yeah, bye-bye.
No third term for Rahm Emanuel. Take your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. You tell us who you'd like to get, and I'll tell you who you're likely to have. Here's Rahm making the big announcement with Amy Rule standing next to him.
Today, the time has come to make another tough choice. As much as I love this job and will always love this city and its residents, I've decided not to seek re-election.
And the reason he's not seeking re-election, Amy, is because that love he discussed is unrequited. He couldn't win.
Yeah, he couldn't win. And he wants to spend, more time with his family.
Politicians always say they're going to leave public office to spend more time with their family. My children were smart enough to see that coming. And they scattered to the two coasts.
They're empty nesters now, Dan, don't you know?
It was nice that they brought a laugh track along with this closeout press conference.
See? There you go. I mean, I'm still in shock, aren't you?
Maybe Ari can get him cast in some, you know,
well, that's the question, too. What's
sitcom.
What he's going to do next? Because I had a Democratic operative call me yesterday on the secret bat line, you know, to my house and tell me that he believes that he's going to be on the ticket in 2020 for president.
Well, your Democratic operative doesn't know what he or she is talking about. That's absurd. That's not what's happening at all.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
Well, yeah,
happening.
I don't think he could have won. There definitely would have been a runoff if he seeked a third term because he had a runoff the second time. So there's a large field of candidates, and that would have been guaranteed that there would have been a runoff.
He left because he couldn't win. And that's why, because particularly the Chicago Press Corps and the C-suite civic leaders are so unimaginative, and despite the fact that they cover it, the Press Corps, ill-informed, that's why they're shocked. Maybe that shock will engender a course correction for their lack of imagination and their lack of attention to detail. They thought that Rahm was inevitable. That's why they're shocked. They thought somehow, some way, through inertia, through because things have always gone this way, one tiny little despot to the other, old man Daley to Daley, burn Washington interregnum, notwithstanding, to Tiny Dancer. And even though he's wildly unpopular, and even though he has no constituency, he's got $10 million and more coming. And he'll just find a way to win because this is the low expectation we have for the Chicago electorate. And they live down to it. So we'll drive them to that low expectation. So that's why they're shocked. You shouldn't be shocked. We talked about it on this show. We've talked about with the field as it's currently constituted. What did I tell you? I think the next mayor is going to be Lori Lightfoot.
Yeah. I'm hoping for Paul Vallis.
The field is going to change.
But that's the thing. If new candidates jump in now, what's wrong with them? They didn't have the cojones to enter their name while Rahm Emanuel was still in the race.
Because
I won't respect he or she for doing that. I don't want any, late entries into this. But now that people are, now that he's out, people are going to be contributing more to other people's campaigns and we'll find out where people stand.
Just watch your mouth because.
Watch it.
You don't tell me that Toni Preckwinkle doesn't have cojones, because I know she does.
But did you see, I mean, during the press conference, it was so strange because Amy Ruhl, and I do respect her for this, never wanted to be First Lady of Chicago. So she did things, you know, quietly. She built her little, Rahm built her little boathouse, you know, near Addison and Rockwell.
You know, where I saw her last?
Where?
When I was lunching at the Women's Athletic Club downtown.
Really?
Yeah. Me and the ladies. And then she was there with a group of her lady friends.
Yeah. So, but yesterday she was there and they were holding hands and it was so bizarre. I know they've been married for 23 years and
27.
I'm sorry.
27 glorious years.
For the last 7.5 years, I've given my all every day and left everything on the field. This commitment has required significant sacrifice all around. Now with our 3 children in college, Amy and I have decided it's time to write another chapter together.
Yeah, and that chapter is going to be, I'm going to go make a bunch of money and be involved probably behind the scenes in the 20 congressional races as well as presidential race. And then if a Democrat beats Trump in 20, then I'm going to try and line up that sinecure I thought I was going to get with Hillary in 2016. That's what I think the play is, and I don't think it's that much more complicated. If he thought he could win, he would be running for a third term.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, remembering Tiny Dancer, your favorite accomplishment of Tiny Dancer, is it the higher debt per capita than Chicago? Is it a violent crime rate more than that of L.A. and New York combined?
Is it the CPS sex scandal? Because I learned yesterday 1,800 CPS employees and volunteers did not pass their background check.
Hmm.
18, and one is a principal, by the way. I'm not going to tell you where, but one is a principal of a school.
Small percentage of a big number, 30,000, 35,000 employees is a big deal.
Yeah.
Is it the highest black unemployment rate in the country?
Well, they're touting his accomplishments yesterday on NBC, and I was just laughing. One thing that he did do that I want to thank him for.
What was his accomplishment?
He extended the school day. School used to get out at 1:45 p.m. Now it gets out at 3 o'clock. And offered full-day kindergarten and pre-K.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're saying that he helped with food deserts and that this is really going to affect the Amazon, getting Amazon HQ here.
Right. It's wasn't coming, and it's still not. Got it. Let me understand. His accomplishments, extending the school day and subsidizing a Whole Foods in Inglewood. Mm-hmm. There's a 7.5-year record.
But I'm
impressed.
I can't believe how many politicians are following Obama, calling him brilliant.
Well, of course.
I'm blessed to call him my friend.
Pro forma statements from
everybody. Mike Madigan, buddies.
It's the Flim Flammer Society. You know, it's the flim-flamming mutual admiration society. And so everybody chimes in for everybody else when one of the thieves is forced out. Robert in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Real quick, you just mentioned it. I'm very curious as how there's a bar 2 blocks away from a school, a Chicago school now, has no air conditioning, but the bar has air conditioning. How does that work? All the money we've thrown into the school system, yet people are, you know, anyhow. Dan, I'm curious, who would you put in there if you could, even though it probably will never happen because I think you're a very brilliant man, and who would you like to see?
Damning me with faint praise. Thank you.
Who would you like to see get in there who might be able to, remember, you're trying to change chicken, you know what, into chicken soup, so it's not going to be easy.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Who would I like to see? I mean, obviously you want to go with a rapper of some sort.
Oh, don't give Kanye or Chance?
Well, Chance, I think, is more au courant. Kanye, I believe he kept Kim's wedding dress here to establish his residency in case he ever wanted to come back.
Well, he does own his mom's house, the house he grew up in. They're going to turn that into a museum, don't you know? But that could be, he could establish residency here.
I mean, Fred Hoiberg, his nickname is the mayor. So maybe, but he's in Hinsdale, I believe.
Yeah. I just think if anybody starts running for mayor now, again, you're scared of Mayor Emanuel, so you didn't take the challenge, but now you want to jump in the race. I just think you look like a wuss.
I agree. What about perhaps a former high-profile network affiliate news reporter.
I have no idea who you're talking about.
From the North Side. You know, that is, you know, rich, vote-rich territory.
Right, right.
You could have Amaya Pawar head up North Side program.
Don't give Amaya Pawar. You know what? What if he runs? I bet he'll run. Hmm. Yep.
Well, I mean, so the new names being discussed in addition to the names now, I mean, it's everybody under the sun, right? Lisa Madigan, not going to happen.
Uh-oh.
Valerie Jarrett.
What?
Sure, of course. We mentioned Preckwinkle.
Oh, come on.
Didn't want to take on Tiny Dancer 4 years ago, had no interest in this. Now she's sort of expressing, I don't think she's got the stomach for it, but she would obviously be the front runner if she got in. Roderick Sawyer, Scott Wagaspack, your congressman from the
Mike Quigley?
Our gang. Yeah.
Not Quigley.
Arnie Duncan.
Duncan.
I mean, you know, it's everybody under the sun now because the money has to go somewhere now that Tiny Dancer is gone and it's not all frozen.
Rahm left with $10 million in his campaign coffers. So doesn't he have to give that money to somebody? How does that work, Dan?
He can use it on legitimate campaign expenses. He can donate it to the candidates.
Okay.
He can give it back to donors. He's not going to do that. He can give it to charity. Those are his options. Bill in the North Suburbs.
How are you?
Good.
I think Rahm's greatest accomplishment was being elected mayor without a legal residence here.
Yeah, that's a nice trick he pulled. I agree. Thanks for the call, Bill. Greg in Schaumburg.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Question. Do you think President Trump will now enter the Illinois situation, and might he do so before the midterms in order to spark the Roskam campaign and just to revive the Republican Party?
Rahm did make this a Trump-free zone. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, that's an accomplishment. Sure.
That's an accomplishment.
Sanctuary City, that's an accomplishment. I mean,
not allowing Chick-fil-A, that they don't share our values.
Well, that's right. He was more focused on keeping Chick-fil-A out of the city than protecting minority families who live in the city.
Yeah. Oh, and then Greg Livingston, one of their reasons for the protest was to have Rahm resign. They must have been celebrating yesterday.
Drop the mission accomplished banner, yeah. Mike on the North Side.
Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we're free at last. This is a day of independence for all Chicagoans and their descendants. Let the joyous news be spread. The 9.5 midget from Wilmette is dead.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike.
I think he's been working on that for a while.
We'll give you a day of celebration before we have to get too far into the what happens next question. Because, it could get you think it can't get worse? It could get worse.
It could get worse.
But at least there's the opportunity for better. So that's important.
Look at you being positive over there.
That's what I am.
I don't even know you anymore.
Sunny optimist.
Who are you?
Don in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. I saw you last night on Fox News, Dan. Good job. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And I think Rahm wants to get out of Dodge because, as we all know, the city doesn't have any more money to pay all these pensions. And the checks start bouncing in 2 years. So he's going to let the next mayor declare bankruptcy.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Don. I mean, I think that's a fair point, too. That's certainly part of the calculus. He pulled a Richie Daley. Here's this mess I've created. You figure it out. And now the mess is bigger, so the next person has to figure it out.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Don't miss David Clark and James O'Keefe at Freedom Summit 2018. Get your tickets today at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about Tiny Dancer's list of accomplishments, which is shorter than that leaflet on Jewish sports legends from Airplane.
Would you like something to read?
Do you have anything light?
Oh, how about this leaflet, Famous Jewish Sports Legends?
Yes, thank you.
And Tiny Dancer talked a little bit about his heritage. How this all came to be, how a little boy named Rahm made his way to the mayor's office.
While he was holding his wife's hand, he cries.
And now I want to thank my grandfather. Who at the age of 13 took an enormous chance a century ago, immigrating here from Eastern Europe, to flee the pogroms prosecuting Jews, to meet a third cousin he did not know in a city whose name he could not pronounce.
Heard this story before.
In 4 congressional runs on the north and northwest sides of Chicago, and in 2 races for mayor, you, the people of Chicago and on the north side, cast aside old history and voted for a Jewish kid with the middle name Israel. I will always be profoundly grateful for that.
Yeah,
and what it means to my family.
Sure, and we'll be profoundly regretful, or at least we should be. His grandfather, I'm sure, was a great man. It skipped over Rahm, that greatness. This is a story we've heard before. This is a rap he's given before, and I don't know. I just I'm in Ariana Grande space. I got no tears left to cry for this guy, honestly. And the intensity of the dislike. There was a picture that was circulating yesterday, Rahm, yeah. I think at one of the airports, or maybe it was a school, it's hard to say, but he was extending his hand to shake the hand of a black woman,
yeah.
And she was just looking at him with her arms crossed like this. I mean, that picture is worth 1,000 words if it's worth a single word about Rahm's 7.5 years as mayor of Chicago, complete and utter catastrophe.
Closed schools, increased our property taxes, city's crime-ridden reputation, not to mention the homicide rate. And then you have the Laquan McDonald shooting. And, with me, timing's everything. Why did he choose yesterday? On the eve before jury selection for Laquan McDonald, right after school starts, he's at this opening at one of the CPS schools, or the first day back at school, and then he called this impromptu press conference for 10:45 at City Hall. Nobody really saw this coming.
Well, people saw it coming. The timing is the issue. But it makes perfect sense, actually. And it makes perfect sense to do it before the trial, because he doesn't want the outcome of that trial or whatever consequences are attendant to the outcome of that trial, whatever reaction occurs on the streets after that trial, to force him out, to be perceived as forcing him out, that he abdicated after the Laquan McDonald trial. So he's getting ahead of it because he looks at it and he says the calculus isn't going to change very much. If anything, probably after this trial, it gets worse for me, and it's pretty bad now. So that's what I think he did. Here's the other thing. just in terms of what a slimy political character he is. I'm sorry. I know he's on his way out, and this is the moment where we're supposed to be gracious. He hurt this city. He made this city worse in every single measurable way. So I'm not going to, because he's crying and he's telling his family history, somehow that all gets washed away. Maybe for some people, and maybe I'm heartless, but not for me. Because I want to focus on what he did and didn't do versus the promises that he made and all the bull jive that so many people bought when he came to town back in 2010 to run in the 2011 cycle. Emanuel talking about his sacrifices. This is the thing that just galls me.
Boy.
Oh, all that he sacrificed to do this job.
For the last 7.5 years, I've given my all every day and left everything on the field. This commitment has required significant sacrifice all around. Now with our 3 children in college, Amy and I have...
Yeah, next chapter. Sacrifices. I don't want to hear a politician tell me about how they're sacrificing to run for office. Then you know what? Don't do it.
I don't want to hear a politician or an overpaid athlete tell me about their sacrifices. Colin Kaepernick.
Oh,
what he said, the sacrifices I've made.
Sacrifice everything. Colin Kaepernick, I
looked at his
stats. To believe in communism, I sacrificed everything. That's why I got this Nike campaign. I mean, Colin Kaepernick is a good example, because tiny dancers, political power, political story can't be told completely and honestly without telling the story of how his political position allowed him to leverage that for $20 million in a year and a half, you know, working as a guy introducing people at Wasserstein Perella.
That's how much he made.
In between, yeah, in between Congress and the running for mayor.
Yeah.
And now he'll go make untold tens of millions more because of his relationships and financial services with those rent-seeking amoralists.
Those who did business with the city. I mean, he's got endless connections to make money.
So just sacrifice. It is so disingenuous. It shows such a lack of respect for you. So when you hear the love that I have and I'll always be here and now my greatest job is to be citizen and to kid.
This, you mean?
It will fill my eyes with tears to leave a job I love. And already my heart is full with gratitude. We've worked together. We have celebrated progress together.
Oh my God.
And we've grieved together. Amy and I have made friendships across the city that will last a lifetime.
Yeah, it's nice. I'm glad. I'm glad
I
you
want
guys
to thank
keep
Amy.
Everybody together.
For being such a remarkable first lady.
Yeah. What? She wasn't the first lady.
We've been together for 27 years.
Yeah.
Okay, come on, snuggle up. Come on.
And when we got married, I told her I would never run for office. And I'm about six elections behind the eight ball.
Yeah, well, so you lied to her like you lied to everybody else.
I would run for office, and that's six elections later. That sounds like a great marriage.
That's a punchline?
Yeah.
I told her I would never run for office. But he was compelled to sacrifice. He's done so much. Compelled to sacrifice the six elections. I'm so tired of hearing this nonsense from ruling class Pauls who are just using this to, one, give their life meaning. Mm-hmm. I need a title. You know, the Napoleonic complex that afflicts the Chicago Democrat
lollipop gang.
Okay, sure, that's apt. And also the complete lack of humility about what happened on your watch. He's getting pushed out. That's what's happening. Not by the insiders this time. He's actually getting pushed out by the residents of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And
I would never
there's,
vote for him.
I know you don't get up at a press conference announcing you're not seeking re-election and say, I suck. I'm not naive. I know.
Yeah, but he could be honest and say, you know, I have failed the people of Chicago in certain ways. In other ways, I've benefited. I've helped them.
Yeah, I wish I can.
But he can't do that. Because always it was always about him. I mean, I remember him saying to me, I want to be the first Jewish Speaker of the House. I want to be the first Jewish mayor of Chicago. It was always about him and his needs and what he wants on his headstone when he dies.
Do you think that he has reserved the Valerie Jarrett suite at the Ronner's Amalfi Coast compound so they can abdicate together? Right? I mean, after November, now he doesn't have to wait to lose in February or April. Now Ronner and Rom get the wine club back together and
still,
right off into the sunset.
Still wonder if they drink white or red wine. Hmm. What do you think?
It depends on what they're having to eat.
Or maybe a Zinfandel? Oh, my gosh. If they drink white Zinfandel, I'm going to send them a pee hat.
Those two seem like spritzer guys to me.
Oh.
Joanne in Schaumburg, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. One thing that you, Amy didn't mention in her list of what Rahm has raised on the Chicago taxpayer is our water bills.
Oh, yeah.
My water bill went from $400 a year in 2009 to 2018, $1,240
yeah.
a year.
Yeah.
Outrageous.
Yeah.
Thanks
extra
for the call,
taxes,
Joanne.
Too. And then the garbage tax, which you get through your water bill.
Yeah. I mean, the nickel and dimes turned into
every month, 10
5 and 10 yeah. and 20 and 100 and $500. I mean, from it's all government aligned against your interests to take from you indirectly or sort of, you know, back channel what they can't take directly in imposing a city income tax or graduating the state income tax or, doing things transparently. They have to do it through fines and fees and, you know, tiered increases in water bills
and
cell
phone
taxes.
And fine you if you don't shovel
so
your walkway. I mean, that was ridiculous. $150 tickets for that.
Mary in Midway.
Oh, you know, I don't go out of my way to follow Ron, but I live in Chicago, so my memory of him will always be, since he started this job to even just recently, every Monday, he'd look in that camera, and it was about all the shootings and killings, and he would say, this will not stand. This will not stand. Yeah. Every Monday morning. It was so insulting.
Thanks for the call, Mary. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our old friend Ron on the South Side.
Hey, look here. You know what? I am just so happy I don't have to hear that lying, whining, failure anymore. He was simply a loser, a failure. He ruined this city. So goodbye.
Thanks for the call, Ron. And Ron from the South Side, this one's for you. Steve in Lake Geneva, you're on Chicago's Morning.
Hello?
Yeah, hey, Steve.
Hello. Oh, hey, good morning, Dan. Love you and love Amy. Amy a little more than you, Dan, but nothing personal.
Yeah, I don't take it personally. He loves you more than me.
Oh, I appreciate that.
I'm just saying Ron's getting out because he can feel the toilet swirling around him, and he's getting out before it's too late.
Yeah, he's like the little tidy bowl man. Thanks for the call, Steve.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and it was the expected clown show, day one of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. Not just the expected preening from U.S. senators about Kavanaugh, to his face at least this time, but really, thank you.
There you go.
For the cameras. Also because of the protesters that were paid to be there. How many were arrested?
There were 70 people arrested.
What are we trying to...
It was just craziness.
Right, so every time you had a senator try to speak, you had somebody step up and make a spectacle of themselves and then get carried out. And then it happened again
and again and again to the tune of 70 times.
Now serving number six. Here's our
This being politics and this being a Supreme Court confirmation hearing... My Democratic colleagues actually I've got to admit, my Democratic colleagues can admit that you're actually a good judge.
How long does it take to get her out of there?
They have to turn the volume up to 11 and try to paint you as one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Anyone who actually knows you knows that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and so, the important thing to take away from this, not only just the hysteria.
Oh.
Not only that, but also that it's all paid and by the left. I mean, this is not organic. This is AstroTurf. And there were a couple of three doctors actually from Texas who showed up because they wanted to actually try and get a seat at the hearing and just experience that, right? Really interesting. And they explained to a reporter on the scene what actually happened, what they witnessed while they were waiting in line. Do we have that drop? Is that Kavanaugh one?
Hello, I'm Dr. Tom Schleter from Texas. We came here just to participate in the hearings, to get in the line. They told us, you know, be out here maybe 8 o'clock, 8:15, 8:30 at the latest, to get in line so we could go inside to hear the hearings. We got here about 8:15. There was already about 100 people in line, and most of them would be probably classified by me as opposing everything that is going on with Judge Kavanaugh. And so we began to see a process of things unfolding while we were standing in line that kept the line from going ahead. One of the things was that there were people that had come along, and it's starting to rain, people that were coming along and had a bag of money, and the people would hand them a piece of paper and then they would give them money. So we knew that money was being exchanged for some of the people to be here just to protest. There was no depth to what their understanding was or anything. They were just here to be a protester, and they were actually told, we heard them say this and instruct them, when you go in, we want you to to yell, to scream, and even to possibly get arrested. So that was some of the process that we saw happening.
So there you go, the details, and just in terms of understanding the left's approach to politics, public discourse, disagreement.
And also, too, this has to be mentioned because this picture, all right, this woman sitting behind Brett Kavanaugh is an attorney.
That was on the brunette that was on screen the whole time.
Yeah, her name is Zina Bash. She's been a law clerk for him. She's been prepping him for the hearings. She was itching her skin and making an okay sign. Somebody on Twitter and social media said that she was making a symbol. It was a symbol of white supremacy. And her husband he issued a statement. Everyone, Zina is Mexican on her mom's side and Jewish on her father's side. She was born in Mexico and her grandparents were Holocaust survivors. She was just scratching her skin. So, I mean, this is the kind of hysteria that people on the left are throwing around on social media.
Well, there was a moment of clarity that was uninterrupted, which was nice. It was Ben Sasse, the Republican senator from Nebraska, who offered a real tongue-lashing to the left at room temperature, but a tongue-lashing nonetheless, and then a tutorial on the Constitution and the problem with what these hearings have become, not because of Trump. It's been this way since Bork. It's been this way for 31 years. Here's Sasse tearing into the screamers on the left to open.
Accused of hating women, hating children, hating clean air, wanting dirty water. You've been declared a quote-unquote existential threat to our nation. Alumni of Yale Law School, incensed that faculty members at your alma mater praised your selection, wrote a public letter to the school saying, quote, people will die if Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed. This drivel is patently absurd, and I worry that we're going to hear more of it over the next few days. But the good news is it is absurd, and the American people don't believe any of it. This stuff isn't about Brett Kavanaugh when screamers say this stuff for cable TV news. The people who know you better, not those who are trying to get on TV, they tell a completely different story about who Brett Kavanaugh is. You've earned high praise from the many lawyers, both right and left, who've appeared before you during your 12 years on the D.C. Circuit, and those who've had you as a professor at Yale Law and at Harvard Law. People in legal circles invariably applaud your mind, your work, your temperament, your collegiality. That's who Brett Kavanaugh is. And to quote Lisa Blatt, a Supreme Court attorney from the left who's known you for a decade, quote, sometimes a superstar is just a superstar, and that's the case with this judge. The Senate should confirm him, close quote.
As Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson said over the weekend, 30 years ago or maybe 32 years ago before Bork, Kavanaugh's confirmation would have been unanimous, but these aren't those times, as Sasse explained.
The reason these hearings don't work is not because of Donald Trump. It's not because of anything the last 20 months. These confirmation hearings haven't worked for 31 years in America. People are going to pretend that Americans have no historical memory, and supposedly there haven't been screaming protesters saying women are going to die at every hearing for decades. But this has been happening since Robert Bork. This is a 31-year tradition. There's nothing really new the last 18 months.
And here's what Sasse said the hearing should be. Here's what it could be and should be, which is important.
What Supreme Court confirmation hearings should be about is an opportunity to go back and do Schoolhouse Rock civics for our kids. We should be talking about how a bill becomes a law and what the job of Article 2 is and what the job of Article 3 is. So let's try just a little bit. How did we get here and how can we fix it?
And Sasse, he went on for about 14 minutes. What he had to say, at least for the first 7.5 minutes, it should be mandatory viewing for every U.S. history class in every high school in America. It should be mandatory viewing for every candidate for public office. Here's just a quick overview of what he said about where our politics are, how far adrift we are from the representative republic vision enshrined in the Constitution.
Number one, in our system, the legislative branch is supposed to be the center of our politics. Number two, it's not. Why not? Because for the last century, and increasing by the decade right now, more and more legislative authority is delegated to the executive branch every year. Both parties do it. The legislature is impotent. The legislature is weak. And most people here want their jobs more than they really want to do legislative work. And so they punt most of the work to the next branch. Third consequence is that this transfer of power means the people yearn for a place where politics can actually be done. And when we don't do a lot of big, actual political debating here, we transfer it to the Supreme Court. And that's why the Supreme Court is increasingly a substitute political battleground in America. It is not healthy, but it is what happens, and it's something that our founders wouldn't be able to make any sense of. And fourth and finally, we badly need to restore the proper duties and the balance of power from our constitutional system.
Yeah, it's a fantastic explanation for how things are working, or more to the point, not working, certainly at least not consistent with, again, the vision of the founders, Sass explaining it in no uncertain terms. And, you know, a hat tip for to Ben Sass for
Schoolhouse Rock.
You got it.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So the question is, with the Rahm's withdrawal yesterday, is this going to be a new day in Chicago? Or ultimately, is it going to be the same old day with a new face? To answer that question, one of the candidates for mayor we've spoken with before, he is former Chicago Public School boss Paul Vallis, candidate for mayor. And he joins us now. Paul, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
So to my question, how do you represent not just a new face, but a new day in Chicago?
Well, I think my whole approach has been to run governmental agencies, not as a politician, but as a problem solver. You know, when I took over the Chicago Public Schools, they had a massive deficit. And when I left the schools, they had about $1 billion in cash balances and 13 bond rating upgrades. And as you remember, I'm sure Amy remembers, I took all the construction projects out of the Public Building Commission so that we could competitively bid them effectively. And we built 78 schools in 6 years. And I think we were paying half the per square footage cost, and that was being spent on other construction around the state, or for that matter, in other cities. So our whole approach toward the schools in those days was to take politics out of the schools and really focus on the kids. And I think that's why we achieved the results. And that's been the approach that I've taken in every single job I've had, whether it was taking over the schools in Philadelphia when the state took over, when those schools were in crisis, rebuilding schools in New Orleans after Katrina. So my approach has always been to be a problem solver and to run the schools as a problem solver, or run any governmental entity as a problem solver and not as a politician.
Do you think it's naive to be able to take the politics out of Chicago city government?
No. Well, first of all, you've got to be committed to doing that. I think people, I think people use politics when they don't have ideas. A lot of times the management of government is more about the managing of the message rather than the managing of programs themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I've always tried to divorce politics from the practice of running the institutions that I've been responsible, while recognizing that we do live in a political environment, but mm-hmm. I've always felt that if you communicate to people what the needs are, what your vision is, and how you're going to work to achieve that vision, you can not only get broad popular support, but you can also get broad political support.
Yeah.
And so, I'm pretty confident, based on my history and what I've done in the past, that I can minimize the damage that politics does to the process of providing quality governmental services. But you've got to have ideas. You have to have the means to run these governmental agencies, whether it's the schools or whether it's the city, effectively. So I think a lot of it, a lot of times, individuals use politics to compensate for what they lack in managerial skills.
Do you think that Rahm has picked his successor? And what do you want to say to men or women that might jump into the race now that he's out of it?
Well, my attitude is, well, has he picked his successor? This is Chicago, so you never know.
Right.
You know, the whole process under which Rahm was more or less selected or ordained last time was certainly, a process that really the establishment desiring a specific candidate as opposed to any credible challenges. But what I say to individuals who are thinking of entering the race right now is that if you didn't have the guts to run for mayor of Chicago when Rahm was in office, what will make the public believe that you have the guts to make the tough decisions that need to be made in order to move the city forward? So,
yeah,
individuals who are going to jump in now, where were you when the going got tough, so to speak?
Well, speaking of that, is there anybody, if they get in, you'll rethink your candidacy? There's rumors John Cass writes about the Bill Daley looking to get in, the rumors that Tony Preckwinkle is looking at it.
No, not at all. Look, Emmanuel may not be running, but the reasons for my running still exist. I mean, the high crime, the poor schools, the lack of economic opportunities, the continuing financial crisis. My whole campaign has really been about offering fresh and realistic solutions for the future of Chicago. And from the onset, since April, and if you go to my website, you can see that, my whole approach has been to really offer solutions with great specificity, and I'm going to continue to do that. So at the end of the day, no one who enters this campaign will deter me from running, because this has got to be a campaign of ideas. And I think, I believe I'm the only candidate with a successful track record of running multi-billion dollar government-owned entities, avoiding the pay-to-play culture, and really, dealing with problems as a problem solver rather than a politician. And I'll compare my record with any candidate currently in the race, or for that matter, any of the candidates out there who might be contemplating entering the race right now. I'm in it to win it, and I'm in it to stay.
I spent a majority of my day yesterday telling people all about you, whether if I was at a tile outlet store at the doctor's house, I was a doctor's office, I should say. But because I've always felt that this is not about you. You really do care about the people. Your wife's a cop. Your sons are both police officers. And I just, what's the website where people can go to learn more information about you?
The website is paulgvallis@forallchicago.com. And if you go to the website, I have all my initiatives are out there for people to examine and make a decision for themselves as to whether or not they think I'm the most qualified.
Vallis for all Chicago.com gets you there. Vallis for all Chicago.com. One quick question though, Paul. So one of the criticisms of you, I would say just constructive criticisms, not personal, but in terms of a political candidate, you're somebody who sounds like you'd be a great chief of staff, but are you a leader in these political times? You know, the kind of the frankly bombastic oratory, the political machinations, the ability to generate resources to drive a message. Can you be that guy that you need to be, at least in part, to be successful politically?
Well, that's always the criticism. I've always had great confidence in the public, and my approach, whether it was in Chicago, Philadelphia, for that matter, New Orleans, has always been to really be honest and transparent and open with the public, and to maybe perhaps be more detailed or offer more specifics than politicians traditionally provide, because I've always had confidence in the intelligence of people to really look at the facts and make sound decisions. And I don't think I've ever been proven wrong. So I've always been able to thrive in political environments because I think I've always been able to articulate a vision. And I've always been open and transparent with people. As Amy remembers, There was never a crisis in the Chicago public schools where I wasn't front and center the next day or that very day answering questions or explaining what I was going to do to resolve the crisis. So my approach has always been to communicate directly with people and then to let them make their judgments. And I think that's always insulated me from a lot of the political machinations that sometimes interfere with good quality managers. So I'm pretty confident that I'm going to be able to get my message out. People want a problem solver, not a politician. And I don't think it's going to be a question of can I raise enough money.
All right. Bring on Bill Daley. Bring on Tony Preckwinkle. Paul Vallis is staying. The website, valisforallchicago.com. Paul, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and we got the next Trump media melodrama cooking, and it's coming to us in the form of Bob Woodward's book,
what's
forthcoming book.
Fears? What's it?
Yeah, something
it's
like
out
that.
September 11th.
Yeah,
nice
but
day to choose.
Yeah, some excerpts have been released, as you know, that I want to do to generate hoopla surrounding the book for book sales, and also audio between Woodward and Trump, which is actually quite entertaining.
I mean,
it's about 11 minutes.
Yeah, I listened to the whole thing yesterday. Did you?
It's just like the...
Repeating the same conversation over and over and over.
It's mostly about why Bob Woodward couldn't get a sit-down with President Trump for his book. And just like all of the like logistics and back and forth between Woodward and Trump and Trump's staff regarding their communications with Woodward about getting a meeting. I mean, it was sort of
I think it makes
sort
President,
of silly.
Yeah, but I thought it made President Trump look good.
Yeah,
Bob Woodward wrote this book, and did he really try to get in touch with President Trump? Well, I mean, did he really make the effort?
Well, I'm sure he did, but the back and forth, this was fun in terms of just kind of Trump's reaction now that it's past post and there was no sit down. You know, Trump's reaction to what is to come.
I learned something about reporting, frankly, Mr. President.
Good.
I've got to go. Good talk to people and see them outside of the White House and outside of their offices, and gained a lot of insight and documentation. And it's, you know, it's a tough look at the world and your administration and you.
Right. Well, I assume that means it's going to be a negative book, but, you know, I'm sort of 50% used to that. That's all right. Some are good and some are bad. Sounds like this is going to be a bad one.
Yeah. Some people cheer, some people boo. That's life. What are you going to do? So it was interesting just how he sort of took it in stride for as much as he supposedly, you know, kind of flies off the handle or is King Lear descending into madness, which Bob Woodward suggested former White House lawyer John Dowd said about Trump, which Dowd denies, by the way. This was part of, though, the exchange where just talking about, like, you know, Trump, like, is on speakerphone. He's got a bunch of people. Hey, you know, you come here. Did you talk to this person? Kellyanne, get over here. Bob says he asked.
Yeah. I mean, six times. What's going on?
Hey, here, talk to Bob. Hey, Kelly, you talk to Bob.
In fact, he just walked in. I'm talking to Bob Woodward. He said that he told you about speaking to me, but you never told me. Why didn't you tell me? I would have been very happy to speak to him. All right, so what are you going to do?
Well,
so I have another bad book coming out.
It goes on, and, you know, I what you can count on is that I've been very careful. And Evelyn, are you on?
Yes.
Evelyn Marge? Duffy, who's
yeah.
my
hey,
assistant.
Steven.
Hello, Evelyn.
Is everybody on? Can we start the call?
Because with permission, I tape people for hundreds of hours.
Good.
And I think there's nothing in this book that doesn't come from a first-hand source. Is that correct, Evelyn?
I believe.
But are you naming names, or do you just say sources?
Yeah, well, it names real incidents, so.
No, but do you name sources? I mean, are you naming the people, or just say, you know, people have said?
I say at 2 o'clock on this day, the following happened, and everyone who's there, including yourself, it is quoted, and I'm Sorry, I didn't get to ask you about these.
I mean, you do know I'm doing a great job for the country.
Trump goes into full Trump. He's sort of like...
talking about the economy and all that he's accomplished.
He's sort of uninterested in... he's sort of humoring Bob Woodward. Yeah, great, good, fine, whatever. Oh, another bad book, big deal. And then goes into kind of full Trump, how well things are going, you know, Mr. Norman Vincent Peale, power of positive thinking
but
guy.
Do you believe anything in the book? I mean, they're saying that he's, you know, reading levels at fifth or sixth grade. John Kelly allegedly calling the White House crazy town. And
Kelly said that Woodward's characterization is patently false and it's simply another attempt to smear people close to Trump in response to that. So we had this before, both Dowd and Kelly disputing what Bob Woodward apparently writes per these excerpts, that one of which you referenced. And then this, too. They go back to, hey, who'd you talk to? How'd you try and get this sit down? Bob Woodward just won't let it go. Hey, Raj Shaw, you talked to Raj. Raj doesn't have access to me. He's like Earl Weaver talking about Terry Crowley.
But you never called for me. It would have been nice, Bob, if you called for me in my office. I mean, I have a secretary. I have 2-3 secretaries. If you would have called directly, a lot of people are afraid that Raj, I hardly have, you know, I don't speak to Raj. I do. And Kellyanne went to somebody, but she didn't come to me. And she should have come to me. She does have access to me, absolutely. She has direct access, but she didn't come to me. And you know what? That's okay. I'll just end up with another bad book. What can I tell you?
It's surprising to me that these people, did Raj have access to you?
Not really, but he would have been able to do it. But I have an office. You have the office number. I have an office that's directly into my office. It doesn't matter. Let me tell you what matters. The economy is the best it's been
in
many, many decades, and it's going to get a lot better. And the country is doing very well. That's what's important.
He's like Linda Richman in Coffee Talk. So I'm going to get a bad book. Big whoop. Hey, what can I tell you? I don't talk to Raj.
Raj? Hey,
you need to know I made maximum effort.
All right. It's too bad.
Yes, sir.
I'm just hearing about it. And I heard, I did hear from Lindsay, but I'm just hearing about it. So we're going to have a very inaccurate book, and that's too bad.
No.
But I don't blame you entirely. All right. Okay. Well, accurate is that nobody's ever done a better job than I'm doing as president.
God.
I
mean, it really is just sort of.
Enough about me. Let's talk about me.
I mean, it's really entertaining. You couldn't have two more opposite personalities, right?
Right.
I mean, but button-down Bob Woodward, Midwestern guy, and kind of the freewheeling, seedier pants Trump.
The New Yorker.
I mean, it's just great. It's just another bad book. He had a lot of credibility problems, Trump added. I probably would have preferred to speak to him, but maybe not. I think it probably wouldn't have made a difference in the book. He wanted to write a book a certain way. So, you know, I guess it's water off Trump's back at this point.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, Chuck Todd.
I'm Chuck Todd.
He says that Rush Limbaugh, Matt Drudge, Fox hosts like Hannity and Tucker and Laura Ingraham are exploiting the fears of older white people. They are thriving financially by exploiting the very same free press umbrella they seem determined to undermine. Is that a fair criticism from one Chuck Todd, the host of the venerable Meet the Press program? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. In this bitchy op-ed, he posted in The Atlantic, potato, potato. He said, there's a new kind of campaign underway to destroy the legitimacy of the American news media, saying that antipathy toward the media right now has risen to a level I've never personally experienced before. The closest parallel in recent American history is the hostility to reporters in the segregated South in the 50s and 60s. Then, as now, that hatred was artificially stoked by people who found it that it could deliver them some combination of fame, wealth, and power. And then he goes on to say such people include Rush, Drudge, Hannity, Carlson, Ingraham.
Oh, Ingraham, and you were on Laura Ingraham's program last night.
That's right, and I didn't feel exploited, even though I'm an older white person.
Did you say something to her?
No, I did not. I hadn't read Chuck Todd's op-ed at that point. But here's the thing. The whole, you know, the heroic reporter, the intrepid reporter. Chuck Todd is suffering indignities not suffered since reporters were covering the civil rights movement and the segregated
South.
He's
not even out in the field. I mean, obviously. You sit behind a posh desk and have a cushy job, and you're there because somebody had a heart attack and died. No offense, but that's how he got his job.
The self-reverence. I mean, just when you think you have seen...
Get over yourselves, people.
The greatest example of self-reverence, the greatest instance of navel-gazing, along comes Chuck Todd.
Yeah, it's embarrassing. I mean, honestly, it's not like he's out there, you know, covering, you know, war zones or something.
So
those people, you might hail them as here. I mean, at least they're putting their lives on the line.
So people,
tell us what's going on.
People that are being paid well, like Rush, Drudge, Hannity, Carlson, Ingram, because they have big audiences. That's a problem. He did not mention Maddow.
No, that's not
a problem. He didn't mention the, I mean, how much money was Brian Williams making before he was outed as a pathological liar? How much do all of these network anchors make and network pundits like Maddow make who are of the left? They're not exploitive. The entire left is bound up in identity politics. It is necessarily exploitive. Somebody texted to me a moment ago, too. Oh, boy. I guess we're over that grace period of bipartisanship that we saw at the McCain funeral service this weekend. It's sending in people to disrupt the Kavanaugh hearing and get arrested.
Paying people to do it.
And now it's this hysteria from Chuck Todd of a different kind, but in the same category of the hysteria of these AstroTurf protesters for the Kavanaugh hearing. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren, calls Brett Kavanaugh a threat to Western civilization. I mean, the hypocrisy and the self-regard is just, it's unmistakable, isn't it?
This guy has producers. I mean, he's got the easiest, most cushy job that you could imagine.
By the way, it's people like Chuck Todd that I think Ronica Cleary was writing about. She's a former White House press corps member. She was the White House correspondent for Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. She writes in The Hill, her op-ed, reporters turn White House press briefings into performances. That's why I quit. She talks about how, they are like jackals. She was 37 and a half weeks pregnant and nobody would offer her a seat in the press room because everybody wants to be in the cross shot. Everybody needs to be in the angle.
Nobody moved for her?
No. She tweeted about it
bad.
At the time.
They did in Chicago when I was pregnant. People would always say, "Hey, have my seat, Jay Levine. Thank you."
No, oh,
I mean Jay.
Fantastic.
That was that was nice of him. And the fact that nobody did that for her speaks volumes.
She's
just sickos.
She says she.
Well, lady's pregnant. Move.
She talks about coming back from her pregnancy leave. I simply could not return to the White House press corps upon the completion of my leave. The press corps had become the story, taking on a life of their own with an us versus them mentality that felt inappropriate, excessive, and charged with bias. I want to report on history in the making, never make myself part of the story, Jim Acosta. However you feel about the current administration, she writes, remember this, the people who are reporting on it are just that, people. There is no official test of morals, integrity, or neutrality to get a seat in the room. The appeal of fame, the power of ego, and the allure of celebrity can affect any one of us, even those of us in the Fourth Estate. Especially, I would say, in the Fourth Estate. In point of fact, as I've said in this show before, the only sector where I've met more people of ill repute than politics, media.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and hit the road, little boy. Rahm Emanuel, Tiny Dancer, gone. Focus on pirouetting out of our lives over the next 8 months, finally.
Maybe you can go back to the ballet.
Tiny Dancer with his significant other, Amy Rule, at the dais yesterday. I had this to say.
As much as I love this job and will always love this city and its residents, I've decided not to seek re-election.
And a applause went up around the city. The difference here,
yes,
as compared to other watershed moments in, say, the last 100 years of Chicago politics with respect to the mayor, it's not a death like Richard J. Daley. It's maybe a little bit similar to Richard M. in terms of being forced out by unpopularity. But I think the smart money at the time was he could have still won re-election. He wanted to get out from underneath all the problems that he created, worsened, metastasized under him that he then handed off to Tiny Dancer. The Tiny Dancer is getting pushed out, not by insiders. He's getting pushed out by the people.
Oh, he said, you know, he's doing this because he wants to spend more time with his family, even though his family is gone.
For the last 7.5 years, I've given my all every day and left everything on the field. This commitment has required significant sacrifice all around. Now with our 3 children in college, Amy and I have decided it is time to write another chapter together.
When he talks about his family, he's talking about his family at Goldman Sachs, GTCR, at Morgan Stanley, that family.
Politicians always say they're going to leave public office to spend more time with their family. My children were smart enough to see that coming. And they scattered to the two coasts.
Yeah, well, the one kid had to get out of town ahead of being arrested for being a drug dealer. Allegedly. I mean, we don't know.
Please.
We don't know because the...
I'm not going to say a word.
Because the cameras...
Well, they just were inconveniently not working that day.
Right. The one on the CTA platform wasn't working. The one...
That Hermitage and Berteau for
working.
Some reason was out.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Allegedly, that was the case. I mean, we don't know.
He did get his tooth knocked out. I mean, it was pretty bad assault. Got to pay the drug dealers.
Drug deals go bad. Sometimes they go violent.
Don't forget,
Tiny Dancer said, as a way to address street crime, take it to the alleys. So that's what they did. For more on this topic, John Cass from Chicago Tribune has written a column on it. Lord of the Flies on LaSalle Street, says John Cass. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Danny.
So,
hello, Amy.
Hi.
So, Lord of the Flies on LaSalle Street, what do you mean?
Look, now that he's out, and you, good call on that because he's out, he's forced out by circumstances. You said earlier that he doesn't want to wear the jacket for Laquan, and that's exactly what would happen. And that forced him out. But now that he's gone, you see Tony Preckwinkle, Bill Daley, Mendoza, Ricky... You know, they're all crawling. It's Lord of the Flies. They're all, like, crawling over the city now.
Well,
who's Piggy?
Yeah.
Well, who
who's Piggy, Dan?
Well, who is most likely to get to the conch shell?
Yeah. Listen, they're all crawling over all over the city now. I listened to Ballas earlier. They didn't have the guts to run earlier. Now they're running, or they're talking about it.
Well, who's they? Like, give us some big names.
I put some in the column. Dan mentioned it. Mentioned people he's heard about. Tony Preckwinkle, Billy Daley, Susana Mendoza, Ricky Munoz. I don't know why he'd be running. They didn't have the guts to run a Latino candidate when Rahm was in office. And now that he's abdicated or is leaving the race... Now there'll be a Latino candidate? It's all a joke.
Well, but, I mean, if there was no Latino candidate on this landscape, I mean, it would show incredible weakness, wouldn't it? I mean, I'm surprised there wasn't one previously, but certainly if there wasn't Latino representation in the race now, it would just make that community look weak politically, wouldn't it?
Well, perhaps, but the community looked pretty weak when they were running 5'6" little Jewish guy with 9.5 fingers is their Latino candidate.
Yeah, that's right? True, too. Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah.
So, in his
what do you guys think?
Well, in his years, what do I think? I'm supporting Paul Vallis. That's what I don't think. That's what I know. And I'm going to put yard signs up everywhere I possibly can. Spread the word about him. What about you, John Cass? Who are you?
I support no one. I'm a journalist. I'm not Chuck Todd. I'm not a I'm not a staffer, a Democratic staffer, blaming Roger Ailes for everything.
Yeah, exactly. But so on the mayor's race, so the prospects of Preckwinkle, for example,
well,
Bill Daley, are you serious? Bill Daley couldn't go the distance with Pat Quinn. That seems to me like, and the idea that people want to go back to a Daley at this point. What about somebody who would be a new face with an old name? New face with an old name, only known to insiders like Jerry Joyce's kid.
Oh yeah. Son of Kaiser Sosa. Yeah, why not?
Exactly. Well, but tell people who this is, because he's in the race right now.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, I did a podcast on the Chicago Way saying Rahm might drop out because of Laquan. And the week before, I mentioned Kaiser Sosa's kid. Jerry Joyce is running. I don't know why. Why would Jerry Joyce want his kid to run unless it's like, you know, I'm going to stake a claim on this piece of the electorate, you know, I guess white Southwestsiders, coppers from 19th Ward, and what are you going to give me to get out, you know, to the other candidates? There's a lot of that going on in politics, Dan. You touch on it when you discuss politics, the inside game, but right now we're going to see a lot of that.
So
a lot of posturing.
Yes.
And what are you going to give me not to get in?
Right. And so Joyce, correct me if I'm wrong, Joyce doesn't have a chance to win. This is a spoiler. This is a, you know, like you say, looking for the quid pro quo. Give me that airport concession contract back and I won't run.
Right. Exactly. That's how I see it. I could be wrong. You know, I could be wrong. I'm a little cynical. But I've only been covering Chicago politics for like 2,000 years now.
Yeah, right.
Well, do you think Mayor Emanuel is going to cut a deal with someone to take his place and he's going to support someone publicly?
Well, Charlie Rose is in trouble now. He doesn't have a TV show to pull that kind of little, bait and switch business that they did with Daley's and Obama. But in this case, I'd say that any candidate who thinks that Rahm's $10 million. He's not going to use that $10 million, or at least some of it, to affect the outcome by still dropping off all research that he's got and other stuff. They're wrong, because Rahm, if he has any kind of future, which I doubt, in politics, he'll have to have a base.
Well, he'll try to
affect the outcome.
Well, so
he'll
what?
Try to affect the outcome.
What about Obama, who's in town to accept a government ethics award from U of I? So that's the genuflecting before the political Christ figure in this state continues. What about Obama's influence here? Why wouldn't another Obama acolyte, if you will, enter this race, and Obama can back that person, a Valerie Jarrett, I don't know, a Melody Hobson, somebody like that, and swamp the field. What about that?
I did mention that, interestingly enough, in today's column in the Chicago Tribune. And all Obama really has to do is what he always does, you know, take some clay, mold it in the shape of an Obama-like figure, and then blow on it and make it real.
Well, what do you think that the prospects are? I mean, look, Arne Duncan was a dutiful rebounder for all those years.
He does is play basketball. Yeah. He goes from gym to gym and plays hoops.
Yeah, what about a reward for that dope?
Yeah, a reward for boxing out, doing the rebounding and passing to Obama?
Yeah.
Make him mayor, sure. Why not? I mean, we're building a temple of love to this guy. You know, $500 million temple of love. Why not do that? Well, I think it's interesting that he could not, you know, one thing I was thinking about, Rahm needed, you know, had so much trouble with African Americans, and I didn't see Obama come forward at all in this kind of chaos period, you know, the Laquan McDonald period, saying, "Hey, Rahm, I've got your back. I'm standing with Rahm. I'm endorsing Rahm." There was none of that. You notice that? It's it's what they don't do and what they don't say, as Dan Prof often says. That's also indicative.
Hey, did Mayor?
And I didn't see that.
Yeah, did Mayor Emanuel accomplish anything in his time as mayor, besides extending the school day?
Yeah, got to built that DePaul, that basketball stadium that nobody goes to
that we don't
to not watch DePaul play.
Yeah.
But just think of this: by not building the DePaul Arena where it should be, there was a lot of development that Brian Hopkins Daley's Alderman that was drawn into the map could administer, right? So he did accomplish some stuff.
Well,
but as to large, yeah. You know, remember, we don't need cops. He kept sending Gary McCarthy out. We don't need cops. We don't need cops. We don't need cops. Right? Well, I think we did need cops, and we did need a lot of them, and they didn't do it.
I mean,
so how's that?
You know, we were talking about Jerry Joyce's kid, and you're talking about some of these inside players and these Daley holdovers and some of the some of those on the city council as well. But do we overstate the substance of the machine in 2018? I mean, Jerry Joyce, Daley, can they really rig an election like they used to be able to? Can they really pick their candidate like they used to? Or are there people that can come in from the outside and through social media, their own fundraising sources, take on anybody that a Daley or a Rahm or maybe even an Obama would back?
I think that most of the political media in Chicago, it has reverence for that band of thugs and gangsters called the Chicago Machine. And I think it's similar to Washington media having reverence for the establishment, hence the genuflecting over the McCain funeral, right, where they talked about how great it was when people reached across the aisle. But mostly, I think in some sad respect, most of us in journalism are not iconoclasts, but we're more like gatekeepers. But that said, there are maybe three or four, five wards that could deliver something. And if Susana Mendoza gets in the race, Madigan could influence those few wards in a large turnout, perhaps help her there. Outside of that, Madigan's like 70, what is he, 7,000 years old? Sooner or later, Methuselah has to go. And all that's changing, too.
Well,
changes you'll see is in the city council. Pat O'Connor's probably not going to run. All these old-timers are like, hey, I'm done.
Will Ed Burke reconsider running again?
I don't know. How many times do you want to see Ed Burke with sombrero standing next to... what are those bands called? You know, the
mariachi
bands.
Yeah. As many times as he'll do it. I love watching politicians defile themselves. So there is a changing of the guard that's happening. I think Madigan's a short-termer as well. Ed Burke's short-termer. The question is there any prospect that changing of the guard will mean a new day in Chicago and not just the same day with new faces?
Yeah, I think so. Ironically enough, Paul Vallis has been around a long time as a technocrat. He's not representative of, as Amy says, of that old school thing. Not at all, because they really hated him. I remember Vallis when he got bounced out of City Hall, and they sent him to the Chicago Public Schools. Daley wanted him to die there. He didn't want him to succeed.
But
and he
succeeded.
Sent him there because Vallis kept asking the one question, why are we buying all this salt from Melrose Park?
Yeah.
and Pat Hewells, the alderman, comes up to me at City Hall and says, hey, what's with the Greek asking these questions about the salt from Melrose Park? I go, I don't know. I'm not in the meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right. Well, sort of some.
Where's the Republican Party, Dan?
Yeah, Dan.
Let's see. You've got Tiny Dancer, who has already reserved the Valerie Jarrett suite at the Ronner's compound in the Amalfi Coast, where they're going to reconstitute the wine club in a couple of months. So that's in the offing. Otherwise, I don't know. Where is the Republican Party? Do you see one, John? I mean, I think the interesting thing is actually the signs of life for the Republican Party, not in the suburbs so much, where the party needs to be strong if it's ever going to be a majority party, but places like the Northwest Side, where there's new people that have come in to constitute an organization and they're running candidates and they're challenging socialists like John Arena. So it's interesting. The toughest landscape is where you see signs of life for the GOP. So maybe there is for the city more so than the state, ironically.
And remember this, Amy, there was a guy who ran for governor and said famously, I was born a poor black child.
Oh, right? Yes.
Yeah, I love that guy.
I still think Dan Proft Dan, you should think about it, man.
All right.
A platform like Cyclone Fences for Everybody. Something like that.
Exactly. I got friends I want to make rich, too. Why can't I run?
That's the point.
Gosh. All right. John Cash, Chicago Tribune columnist extraordinaire. Check out his most recent offering, Lord of the Flies on LaSalle Street in the Tribune. John, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's going to get crazy around here. Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Mr. Proft, your response.
Yeah, like everybody else, I was born a poor black child, too.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2, right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560 The Answer.
Well, it was a colorful day yesterday between the paid protesters at the Kavanaugh hearing, and I'm not talking just about the U.S. senators, in addition to them, to the audio of Trump's exchange with Bob Woodward regarding his inability to figure out a time to sit down with Woodward or get the message that Woodward wanted to sit down in advance of his book on the Trump administration, which is a rite of passage for presidents for about the last 50 years with respect to Woodward. And, you know, and well, 50, maybe exaggerating, but last 35 years. Yeah. But, I mean, Trump, just the way Trump kind of brushed it off, I don't know, a message didn't get to me, but it sounds like I'm going to have another bad book. What are you going to do? It comes with a job. I don't care. The important thing is focusing on all the good that I've done, because things have never been better for the country than under this guy.
But you never called for me. It would have been nice, Bob, if you called for me in my office. I mean, I have a secretary. I have 2-3 secretaries. If you would have called directly, a lot of people are afraid that Raj, I hardly have, you know, I don't speak to Raj. I do. And Kellyanne went to somebody, but she didn't come to me. And she should have come to me. She does have access to me, absolutely. She has direct access, but she didn't come to me. And you know what? That's okay. I'll just end up with another bad book. What can I tell you?
It's surprising to me that these people, did Raj have access to you?
Not really, but he would have been able to do it. But I have an office. You have the office number. I have an office that's directly into my office. It doesn't matter. Let me tell you what matters. The economy is the best it's been in many, many decades, and it's going to get a lot better. And the country is doing very well. That's what's important.
That's what's important, says President Trump to Bob Woodward. Is he going to continue to be able to say that through the fourth quarter of this calendar year? For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Stephen Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, guys.
So what about that? The economy is doing better than it's done in decades. Things are going good with the country, and that's the important thing, says President Trump.
Well, obviously, yeah. I mean, the economy is firing on all cylinders right now, no question about it. And we're actually seeing a pickup in growth now. I mean, the latest forecast for the third quarter GDP, which, you know, at the end of September is when that quarter is over, 4.5% growth. And that's something almost all the liberal economists said was impossible, because, of course, the Messiah couldn't get us to 3-4% growth. So how could Donald Trump possibly do it?
Mm-hmm.
So he's right. I mean, and by the way, you know, during the campaign, as you know, Larry Kudlow and I worked, you know, with Trump during the campaign, that every single poll that we looked at from the time he first started running for president in April of 2015 through Election Day, the number one issue for the country was jobs. The number two issue for the country was the economy, jobs in the economy. That's what it was all about. And now we've got, you know, this turbocharged economy. And it's so interesting to me, nobody in the media wants to talk about the economy anymore. Now, let me make another point, though, if I may, because, you know, I do know Donald Trump. I've gotten to know him pretty well. Uh-huh. And I am a great admirer of his. I mean, I think what he's done on the economy has been fantastic. But one of his fatal flaws, one of his flaws that we're now discovering is he's not always the best judge of character. You know, and some of the people that he surrounded himself with in the White House and in the campaign were just not upstanding people. And they were people who were, you know, like, what's this woman's name? Ambrosia or the
Amorosa.
You know, who goes to the White House and tapes every conversation? I mean, that's such a subversive activity. And then, you know, people like, you know, we know that one of the major sources for the Woodward book is Gary Cohn.
Yeah.
Gary Cohn was going to be Hillary Clinton's chief economist. And somehow, right after the election, Donald Trump falls in love with the guy, and he becomes the chief economist, not Larry Kudlow, because it wasn't Kudlow out of the gates. And I had predicted, by the way, I think I predicted on this show, but I know I predicted. I said, you know, 6 months after Gary Cohn leaves, he is going to either write a book, you know, trashing Trump, or he's going to be the source for a book that trashes Trump. And unfortunately, I was right about that. So I think the problem is, you know, Trump has surrounded himself with some people are never Trumpers.
Well, yeah,
and Michael Cohen, not to mention his personal attorney.
But also Gary Cohn, there's another cautionary tale there. We talked about it when he was named, and that's the revolving door of guys from Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, the big rent-seeking banks, that these amoral scumbags like John Corzine and Gary Cohn may be just a step or two above that.
You got it. You got it. It is the revolving door. That's a great way to describe it. And, you know, it's Robert Rubin. Remember him?
Yeah.
He was a Goldman Sachs guy. I mean, you could go down the whole list of people who worked as chairman of Goldman Sachs. And by the way, do you think it's a coincidence, Dan and Amy, that every time we make a financial decision, you know, that the government, you know, changes the rules, what company always comes out smelling like a rose?
Yeah, Goldman Sachs, like when they got bailed out AIG to save Goldman in the recession.
You know, and so that's how these people get rich. And so that was a big mistake. One other quick thing about the Woodward book. You know, last night I was watching CNN and you know, they were just pillorying Trump. And one of the few Trump people they had on said, well, look, you know, you can't always believe everything that Bob Woodward says. And, you know, the sources, you know, half of the sources in the book, by the way, have already said I never said that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So and anyway, CNN said, oh, my God, it's Bob Woodward. He's a god. He doesn't lie about this stuff. I mean, he's an unimpeachable source. Well, there's a very famous story that he wrote a book, Woodward, back maybe 25 years ago about Bill Casey. He was the director of the CIA under Reagan.
Blame the
dead
guy.
I don't know if you know the story, but Woodward claims that he had an interview with Bill Casey literally on his deathbed when he was in the hospital, where he basically, Bill Casey spilled his guts apparently to Woodward and said, everything we did was wrong. And, you know, it was like this deathbed conversion by Bill Casey. Nobody believed it was true. They have cameras in the hospital. A family member was with him every single day in the last week of his life. There was zero opportunity for Bob Woodward. Completely made that up. Completely made it up.
Really?
Well,
this is the guy who we say, oh, he's unimpeachable. He never makes things up. We know with almost 100% certainty he made up that story.
Well,
it never happened.
Well, it's not even about Bob Woodward. The idea that anyone in the media would say someone is unimpeachable, we don't have to examine it because this person is unimpeachable. Well, what kind of journalism is that? No one is unimpeachable, especially in politics and media.
You and Amy are unimpeachable, but other than
Amy
that,
is not me. one other thing, just on personnel decisions, since you were pointing this out with respect to Gary Cohn in the book, how about the trade team, Navarro, Wilbur Ross, Lighthizer? Good personnel decisions.
I don't always agree with Peter Navarro, but Peter Navarro was a guy with Trump from the beginning, and he has an outlook on China that is maybe different than mine and Larry's. He's, you know, he wrote a book called Death by China. Trump, you know, was taken by that stuff, and so I don't have a problem with Peter Navarro being part of that group. Lighthizer, I don't always agree with him on trade. He actually knows a hell of a lot about trade law, and that's a big advantage when you're in these negotiations because there's thousands and thousands of pages of trade law. And Wilbur Ross, look, he was there. You know, he was there with Trump from the beginning as well. But the most important thing for Trump, I think, is to have both sides. You know, if you're going to have people like Wilbur Ross, who's more of a trade protectionist than I am, at least you need somebody like, you know, Mnuchin and a Larry Kudlow to balance that debate. So I don't have a problem with those three. I just hope that the free marketeers prevail in some of these debates. And frankly, I actually think Trump is winning on trade. I really do. I think he got a big deal with Mexico that is more advantageous to the United States. I will predict on this show that within a week or two, Canada is going to come hat in hand and make very substantial concessions to Trump because they can't be the odd man out when it comes to NAFTA. And then you move to the EU, and then you move to China. And I think by the end of this year, Trump is going to have trade deals that lead to freer trade and fairer trade for the United States. When that happens, it goes back to your original question. Will the economy continue to prosper? If he gets these trade deals done, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Right, from your mouth to Trump's ears. One local issue I wanted to have you tackle. Okay. Illinois just set the record. So, you know, you're a native Illinoisan, North Shorean.
Yeah.
So I wanted to celebrate
for?
This for you. We broke the record for pension debt in United States history. Thank you very much. Congratulations. It took everybody.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of credit or lack of credit to go around. As Moody's Investor Service released a report at the end of August, Illinois' unfunded liabilities grew 25% in 2017 to $250 billion.
Yep.
That equates to 601% of own source revenue, meaning money brought in by the state, excluding federal funds. The ratio of pension debt to revenue is the highest on record for any U.S. state. The national median is 1/6 of that, 107%.
Whoa.
Wow. So, you know, I have a solution to the problem.
Okay, what is it?
Issue more debt.
Okay.
I mean, I thought that was the Illinois solution.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That, hey, we found a way out of this. We're gonna get rid of the pension debt by issuing other kind of debt.
Taking the pension.
I mean, I'm not making this up, right? I mean, isn't that what the politicians come up with?
We're gonna
switch bond A with bond B.
We have,
and therefore, voila, only the people in Springfield can come up with that kind of solution.
We follow the Joe Biden philosophy here. We need to continue spending to keep from going bankrupt.
Exactly. But look, I mean, why would anybody move to Illinois and buy a house there when, you know, a lot of what you're going to be paying for in terms of your record high property taxes is not for any government services. You're just going to be paying for the debt for the services that were provided 20 and 25 years ago.
Bingo. Steve Moore, CNN chief economist, Wall Street Journal columnist. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Okay. Have a great week, guys. Take
you
care.
Too.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, with jury selection this week in the Jason Van Dyke trial, we've heard from Jason Van Dyke, at least in printed word, in the Tribune last week.
Yeah,
we heard from his wife on Windy City Live on Monday. We'll get to that, but we've also heard now from a family member of Laquan McDonald.
Yeah, Laquan McDonald's great uncle, he's the closest family member who's going to be the spokesperson for the family, urged calm and urged for peace no matter what the verdict is.
We're asking for complete peace. We don't want any violence before, during, or after the verdict in this trial. And so we're asking all the people that are concerned about this, that have tried to help us, that are here because they say they want to help our family, to honor our wishes in this way. I want to make it clear that no one has set me down and asked me to say this. I haven't had any meetings with the mayor. In fact, this family has never talked to Rahm Emanuel. I even received condolences from the mayor of the city of Chicago as it pertains to this matter.
Well, two things. Interesting. One is he's more responsible than the civilian political leadership of this city. At least he's making a call for calm regardless of the verdict. That's the responsible adult thing to do. So good for him. Number two is if the mayor's office or the mayor maybe specifically never made contact with the family, how'd you get the settlement? How'd you get
somebody from the office? Someone from the city contacted.
No, I know, but I want to hear more about that. I want to hear more details. I mean,
I don't know if he knows because mom is the one who got the $5 million, and the mom, they can't find her. She's supposed to testify in the trial, and she's not around.
Well, he may not know, but it's time that we revisit all the questions that didn't get asked and didn't get answered when this went down. Because Tiny Dancer was part of pushing all of this off past the previous election, and now, of course, it's come back in part, many other things as well. to bite him and end his political career as well it should.
And don't seek revenge, Mr. Hunter says.
Not looking for revenge. Most people that talk to me as if they're trying to urge me or nudge me into saying that this family is looking for revenge. This is horrific. It is terrible what happened to Laquan. Laquan is certainly the victim. He is certainly the victim in this matter. Jason Van Dyke is the perpetrator.
No. No. He was charged with first-degree murder, Jason Van Dyke. Jurors are going to be there today, just potential jurors, filling out questionnaires, and then the trial is actually going to start, well, on Monday, if it remains here in Cook County.
Right.
That's what we'll find out.
Right. Remember, the judge, with respect to the motion for change of venue, kicked it past voir dire, and then he's going to make a ruling on the defense's motion for change of venue. So we'll see if the trial stays in Cook County or not. Remember, the defense presented evidence for the judge's consideration that 85% of Cook County residents have made up their mind as to Van Dyke's innocence or guilt in furtherance of their motion for change of venue. So we'll see.
And there is also a Chicago rapper who was the grand marshal of the Bud Billiken Parade who has a hit song called 16 Shots. And so Dan Hubert brought that up. He's the attorney for Jason Van Dyke. He brought that up as well when he was asking for a change of venue because it's a popular song and people, you know, are affected by music.
It's a popular song, and it's also a popular taunt, I guess, to Van Dyke's kids in school.
Yeah, Tiffany sat down and spoke on Windy City Live to discuss what her daughters go through.
Both my children actually are bullied at school. My oldest came home from school one day. She didn't even come home. She called me halfway through the day, crying. And I said, "What is the matter?" And she said, "Somebody wrote 16 shots on her desk." My 12-year-old... innocent 12-year-old sat in her classroom and another student called her father a murderer to her face.
I mean, look, it's devastating for both families, but the issue at bar is Van Dyke's judgment call on that night in that moment, and that's what a jury will decide.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. When Cardinal Supich sat down with Marianne Ahern, Blaise Supich had this to say about the rolling and roiling allegations of sexual abuse within the church.
This is not about sex. It's about power and clericalism. That's what has to change in the life of the church, and that's what the Pope is talking about. But let's also be clear that people who want to make this about sex in terms of homosexuality and all the rest of it are a diversion from the real issue that we need to attack in the life of the church.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, let me introduce you to two priests that Mike Scott's been reporting on this morning. Father Diego Berrio, 39, Father Edwin Giraldo Cortez, 30, both priests assigned to the Mission San Juan Diego Parish in Arlington Heights, who were arrested in Miami and charged with lewd and lascivious behavior after pedestrians and the police observed the two priests performing oral sex in a parked car.
In broad daylight. Yeah.
But it's not about sex, and it's not about homosexuality and the expression of it that's tolerated in the church and has been for a long time. It's not about that.
No, the two were easy to spot, too, because they were near a playground and didn't have tinted windows.
Maybe those priests in Miami should have said they were there to check on rising sea levels due to global warming, and then Cardinal Supich would have embraced them.
I shouldn't laugh, but that's...
Supich also said this during his sit down with Marianne Ahern, and this being broadcast obviously was the source of so much criticism directed at Cardinal Supich's way, which he tried to reverse by saying he didn't mean what he said and dispatched priests last Sunday for Sunday masses, Saturday and Sunday masses, to challenge and decry the unfair editing NBC5 did of Cardinal Supich's words.
Does the Pope need to tell Catholics exactly what he knew about Cardinal McCarrick and when he first knew it?
Well, I think that the Holy Father on the airplane had exactly the kind of answer that was needed. He was asked about the letter of Archbishop Vigano. He said he read it. He encouraged the media to read it carefully and to come to their own conclusions, and that he would not have any final any other statement on it. I think what he was signaling is two things. The first is that you have to see whether or not these remarks stand up to scrutiny. There are so many things in there that he says about so many people that it's impossible to try to get into the weeds on this. And he trusts the media to use their skill, their expertise, and he said their maturity to explore these questions. For instance, look at the language of the letter and compare it to the language that's in these websites and news outlets that release the document. There's so many parallels there in terms of the kinds of things that they're attacking the Holy Father and other people about. The other is look at these various things that are said on an individual basis. That's why I clarified it.
See, and then, of course, he made the famous, infamous now, rabbit hole comment about we've got big issues, environmentalism and migrants. We're not going to go down this rabbit hole. It seems to me, from watching the entire interview, and that was just an example of how much bandwidth Supich was given to say whatever he had to say with as much specificity as he wanted to say it. Also, his dispatching priests to be PR flacks for him belies the fact that he can supplement the record with more specific comments on any of these topics anytime he wants, and he chose not to do so. Supich has behaved in a disgraceful manner as far as I'm concerned, and I you know, you get to have an opinion whether you're Catholic or not, but I happen to be a member of the church, and I attend Holy Name, and he's behaving like a politician, like the guy who just announced he's not seeking re-election yesterday. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by the interviewer and a target of one Supich in question. She is Marianne Ahern, political reporter for NBC5 in Chicago. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a busy time.
Indeed. So how did you react to the missive that Supich sent out per your interview of him?
I was surprised. I was surprised. I think, Dan, if we had not posted the entire interview already, we did the interview Monday. My time, by the way, was 3 p.m. You know, everyone got a different time. 3 p.m. isn't exactly, you know, the best time in the world when you have a 5 and 6 o'clock story. But, hey, that didn't ever really, you know, always better to have more time. But whatever. That was our time. We did our story at 5, we did our story at 6, we did our story at 10. No one from the Archdiocese said anything. Tuesday, we posted the entire interview. It isn't instantaneous. It takes a little bit of process to post all the various sections on the web and also have the copy to go with it. And we have lots of other stories going, but so it took us till Tuesday, but we posted it then. Again, not one word from the Archdiocese. Nothing. Zero. Nada. Wednesday at 5 p.m., there was a statement that I did not receive that other people in the newsroom received. It appeared, I don't know this absolutely, but it appeared I was deleted from the list, since I often get emails from them. Someone else sent it to me and said, did you see this? So he put out a statement Wednesday night. It took 48 hours to complain, and still nothing directly to us, to me. And so I thought, wow, you know, that's kind of odd. You know, I mean, if you don't like, we certainly hear from people when they don't like their story, you know. And I get it. You know, you interview someone for 12, 15 minutes, whatever it might have been, and we put up three different stories using a couple of the same sound bites. But, you know, probably maybe 5-6 minutes were aired over the day of the news. And of course, as the person who's been interviewed, you go, darn it, I said this too, and I said that too, and, you know, why did they only take that? But we posted the entire interview.
Right. I mean, you can't get able, more, you know, transparency.
Yeah. I mean,
that.
You know, if they had shamed us into doing that, it would be a different story. But we already did it without any complaint. So if you happen to see, they posted their statement, the Cardinal statement on Wednesday on their Facebook page. 90% of the comments, I'm shocked they didn't take it down, but 90% of the comments are, well, I did watch both. I watched the on-air and I watched the unedited, and they're the same. We stand by our story, and I'd like to move on. But we stand by our story.
Well, it should be a badge of honor, you know, to be blasted by Cardinal Slupich, because I think maybe he's mad at himself and, you know, pushing this off on you and NBC5. I mean, I don't know what else to... Did he go after Chuck Gowdy? Because I know Chuck Gowdy interviewed him, too. Did he mention anything about ABC7?
He said the same things. Now, I don't know if he actually used the words rabbit hole to everybody, mm-hmm. but he said many of the same things to me, to others as well. So I don't know exactly why. I mean, I get it. I'm not exactly, you know, a shy flower in the corner. But I mean, I reported what he told us.
Right.
I'm not quite sure what the whole, you know, and then to have the priest read the letter, that was really over the top.
Well, you've covered the Archbishops and Cardinals of Chicago for some time now. How would you compare covering Supich and your interactions with him now that he's been here for a spell to previous cardinals, George, Bernadine, others?
Well, you know, the Archdiocese, and I've said this even to them, their goal is, and as any organization, their goal is to always make their folks look good or you know, to promote whatever their message is. That's not my goal. You know, I mean, my goal is not to make any, my goal is to go ask questions, find out what the answers are, put them on the air. And my goal is also not to tear down people. I mean, my goal is just to ask questions and to get answers to them. And so they do seem to be on much more of a mission of that image conscience than perhaps a Cardinal George. But did I ever tangle with Cardinal George and Cardinal Bernie? Yes. Yes, that's the nature of the job. We often do stories that folks don't like. That but did it ever get to this?
No.
Absolutely not. No. And wait, Cardinal Bernadine, are you kidding? I was there. We were the first ones to do the stories about all this awful stuff,
right.
The priest sex abuse.
Right.
They wanted to, they called me and said, you know, how dare you? You're Catholic. Why would you do that? I mean, of course I've had all that. They didn't, and I don't recall a letter being read at the masses before. I mean, that was
once.
But, yeah. But no, I mean, there are always times. You know, hey, we're talking about the mayor. I mean, remember the time the mayor went crazy on me? I mean,
yep. Yeah, he barked at you.
He had a temper tantrum.
Yeah.
No, he did. He literally had a temper tantrum.
You got to be thick skinned. It's hard.
Well,
it's hard.
Yeah.
But, you know, I get it. It might not, I don't know if it's personal to him. It's not personal to me, but maybe it's personal to him.
We'll keep up the good work. Big news yesterday, obviously. Mayor Daley, or no, not Mayor Daley, Mayor Emanuel,
no.
Announcing that he's not going to run for re-election. You were in the room. What was it like?
Here's the difference. 8 years ago, I was in the room, and there was only about five of us in the room the day that Mayor Daley announced. We had no idea when Daley did it. We really didn't. We all thought that it was Jody Weiss was going to get fired.
Oh.
And I had called Jackie Hurd that day because I was out in the suburbs. And I said, what's going on? What's an announcement? She goes, you need to get here. And I was like, okie dokie. You know, Rand got there fast. And there might have been five reporters. All the TV cameras were there, but not a lot of reporters were in the room. Yesterday, when it happened again, people were – no one took anything for granted. I wasn't privy to anything. However, Carol Marine had been – kind of hearing it the last couple of weeks or months. Fran's article this last weekend that I should have read a lot more carefully, but she certainly sent a signal. So when they called our newsroom yesterday, when the staff of the mayor's staff called and sat around, I don't know, maybe 9:45, and said, hey, the mayor's got an announcement at 10:45. I ran to do makeup fast.
Yeah.
I was like, okie doke, I think there might be a problem here.
And why yeah. do you think he made the decision he made and announced it yesterday when he did?
It had to be the polls. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that also play a role. I mean, the Van Dyke trial starts. No matter which way the Van Dyke trial goes, if it doesn't, you know, if it goes poorly for him in some way, do you look like then you got, you know, thrown out the door? This is a way for him to say that it was his decision. Clearly, the polls were not in his favor. They keep telling us there was a path to victory, but it wasn't certain. This is not a guy who's about to get into a race he's going to lose.
All right. And then is he going to take reporter questions today?
Yes, heading that way at 10:30 today. So trying to hopefully he's not going to stand up and bark at me again.
Yeah.
The most hilarious part, the photographer that went with me, Ron, and Amy, you probably know Ron, he was the one that was with me that day that he barked at me. And he called me last night, and I said, Ron, no matter what I tell you today, do not turn the camera off.
Exactly. Now, is he going to use Amy Rule for personal protection again, or is he going to stand up there by himself?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. And even he did the line of politicians like to say they're going to spend more time with them. Please, give me a break. This guy
spend time with your family. Your family's gone. I mean, they're all in college.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah. It's strange.
He needs a better speechwriter, but he also, he's just not really that great on the stump. He's not very entertaining.
Well, who do you think? Who do you think it's going to be? I don't think it's going to be these folks that are, I mean, who knows?
I don't know. I think it's between Common and Chance the Rapper. That's what I think. She is Marianne Ahearn, political reporter for NBC5. Marianne, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So Tiny Dancer is making the rounds to answer questions. Obviously, he's not going to come on this show because we asked tough questions, hold him to account. He's not so amenable to that. But he was asked, one outlet, is the next mayor currently in the race?
I don't think so. Here's the thing. The public knows that this is a very big job, and the mayor cannot be a one-trick pony. You can't just speak on one issue. You got to do economic development. You got to do education policy. You got to be able to get money out of Springfield and Washington. You got to have an ability to actually invest in our neighborhoods, transportation, libraries, schools, and parks.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. You get it. Yeah. I mean, you can't be a one-trick pony. You know, you need to be able to attack Chick-fil-A. You need to be able to demagogue the crime issue.
You got to make Chicago a Trump-free zone.
You got to make a Trump-free zone.
That was the weirdest.
Yeah, you got to juggle
so
a lot of balls.
Stupid.
Yeah, like a clown. He was asked his biggest failure as mayor.
It's clear is not having people kill people in their own neighborhood and community. It's in their own parts of it's. You have I can give you parts of the city that are as safe as Manhattan, Los Angeles, and I give you other parts. It's just. And I will grapple. I understand poverty. I understand all the conditionality that goes into them, but it's not determinative. It's influential, but not determinative. And I will never get the idea that somebody can walk an 11-year-old off a basketball court, walk him 100 feet as retribution, and at no point in that 100 feet does a moral voice go off and say what I'm being asked to do is wrong?
How many bodies have to pile up before you believe that man's inhumanity to man sinks to that level? I mean, I can't get over the reality on the ground, so I didn't do anything. I mean, we had John Cass on talking about, you know, he's always pushing off the commitment that he made actually as a candidate for more police on the streets. He talked about the policy of containment in 4 of Chicago's 21 police districts. He's right that poverty is not determinative when it comes to crime. That's exactly the point. The overwhelming majority of the residents in those 4 police districts where the most of the violent crime occurs are law-abiding, and so they deserve the same police protection as anybody else in the city. And obviously, they weren't getting it. The way he said it, too, it's still dissociative. He must have learned that from his boss, Obama. People killing other people. No. The government, I mean, yes, but the government fulfilling its primary responsibility to maintain peace, to protect constituents, to police areas such that people are afforded, law-abiding people are afforded to live in peace. That's what I fail to do. Whatever strategy that I employed with the police, personnel decisions I made with the police, it was a failure. Some parts of the city are as safe as Manhattan and L.A. Right. But you're the mayor of the entire city. And with respect to the entire city, the murder rate was higher than L.A. and New York combined with one quarter of the population. That's being accountable for what he didn't do. What you heard there is the typical political answer you get from the typical politician in this state.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, Tiny Dancer is out, but hey, he's going to make these last 7 months memorable.
We have more to do, and from now until then, we'll do everything in our power to get it done and walk out the door, hopefully leaving Chicago and Chicagoans in a stronger place.
Ah, we're back to his old boss's strategy of hope, because that's the only thing that he has to offer to make Chicago a better place than he found it. Everything that he inherited, all the problems, and there were many, exacerbated under his leadership, in quotation marks. That's a fact. Those are the numbers. Who replaces him? It was interesting. He said this morning that he doesn't believe the next mayor is in the race at this moment.
Right.
So he believes and probably has some involvement in whoever may enter that would be the heir apparent to continue the same old way of doing things that we've been doing for 100 years.
Yeah, I knew that he would handpick somebody or try to play a part in that. He does have $10 million in campaign funds that he could throw someone's way. But when I heard that, you know what my gut reaction was? Valerie Jarrett.
Well,
it scares me.
Here's the thing. It's got to be, if it looks like it's his handpicked successor, then that person is going to be carrying a lot of baggage coming into this race. So so if I was, working with Tiny Dancer to get into the race and leverage his support, I certainly wouldn't want to present that to the public because I don't think it will be received well. There's a reason he left. It's because he had lost any semblance of popular support for his policies in this city. And by the way, I mean, how many more decades do we have to do this before we recognize that the Chicago Democrat model of governance is a failure? I mean, how many more decades? Centuries?
Know.
I don't know. What is the probationary period to consider something systemically different than what we've had? I mean, I honestly don't know the answer to that question.
I don't want my property taxes going up anymore. I don't want any new taxes. I had a garbage tax implemented while he was here.
I mean, right. I'm talking about those are things on the margins. The system, all of the systems, the city's finances, the overall tax burden, the environment in terms of economic opportunity outside of a few wards. Obviously, safety. The schools. The real estate market. Shall I continue? Steve in Hinsdale, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Well, my question now is, given the fact that Dancer has quit, which is good, can we still blame all the relentless, ongoing black-on-black gun violence as his fault? I mean, who do we now blame for black people shooting and killing each other? Still the Dancer, or does somebody else get the blame now?
I'm not. Thanks for the call, Steve. I'm not clear on this. People who commit violent acts against other people are responsible. But we pay taxes and we set up governments to police human interaction to make sure that when people violate the rights of another, they're arrested and then they're prosecuted. So, I mean, I don't think it's funny to pretend that abdicating that responsibility, as Tiny Dancer did for the last 7.5 years, and piling up 5,000 dead and 20,000 shot, is something you just wave off and pretend we're scapegoating him. We're not. 5,000. You want a big job? Big accountability. If you don't want the big accountability, don't run for the big job.
Well, I don't want to hear this. It was a sacrifice, the sacrifices he made.
Yeah.
You wanted the job, you took the job. Stop whining.
Totally.
I mean, sacrifices. It just reminded me of Colin Kaepernick.
Holly and Hudson, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I want to help Rahm out. He cannot figure out how somebody can't walk 100 feet off a basketball court and somewhere in that 100 feet have their conscience changed. Well, guess what? When you marginalize character, when you blur the lines from right and wrong, when you denigrate the role of authority in a child's life, they don't have the tools that Rahm is expecting them to have and that Rahm's kids have to use. And he needs to wake up, as does everyone else in this society and in Chicago, and see that they are just reaping what they sow.
Thanks for the call, Holly. Well, what could Chicago be? We have this opportunity for a new day. Maybe the answer of what it could be, rather than just sort of cynically or optimistically predicting what it will be, particularly cynically, but what it could be. Maybe that conversation starts with defining what Chicago values are. It was a phrase that Tiny Dancer liked to throw around a lot, usually to for political purposes, to pander to the identity politics set or to attack a business like Chick-fil-A.
What my friend said yesterday, she lives in Lincoln Park, she said, I just want to live in a world where I feel safe walking down the street. And I haven't felt safe in 2 years.
So maybe that's
all the police officers are going. She's like, I haven't seen a cop. I took a picture when I saw two police officers walk down my street.
I mean,
for the first time in 7 years.
The city is beset by so many problems that are sort of DEFCON 5 in nature. I wonder if maybe the conversation and the challenge to all the candidates should be one of first principles. Kind of establish your vision for the city based on the principles that will inform your decisions and your policy choices. Maybe that's the starting point rather than talking, you know, about this this tax or these red light cameras or this particular neighborhood or this particular school. I mean, it's going to require big ideas and paradigm shift to change the future of the city and the crumbling civic institutions that punctuate it, isn't it? Or you think like, I respect Paul Vallis, but this is not a job for a technocrat, which is why I'm unconvinced at this point that he's the man for the job. This is not just a green eyeshades problem. It's a big picture. It's a first principles problem. And so it seems to me you have to establish that foundation before you get to the policies that flow from those principles in such a way that you can bring people along to do big things and make big changes. Marianne and Homer Glenn.
Oh, hi, Dan. I wanted to say why Rahm is dropping out is because of the fact he thinks Pritchard's going to win. And if Pritchard wins, all the taxes and everything else, and he doesn't want to dirty his name with it.
Okay, thanks for the call, Marianne.
Or it could be the fact that, you know, the CPS sex scandal, you know, 1,800 CPS teachers, volunteers, and one principal did not pass a background check.
Right.
246 just flat out refused to take it.
And remember the superstars that Tiny Dancer brought in to run CPS, Barbara Bird Bennett, who's now in federal prison.
Yeah.
And Forrest Claypool, who had to resign under a cloud of wrongdoing himself.
Right.
So, yeah. superstars, change agents. Charlotte in Arlington Heights.
Hi. Sanctuary cities, the mayor couldn't distinguish between legal and illegal immigrants. We're a welcoming city. That's the rule of law.
Well, right. Thanks for the call, Charlotte. I mean, this goes again to my point about Chicago values. Picking and choosing the rule of law was a Chicago value under Tiny Dancer. Should it continue to be? Don in Bloomingdale.
The only question every politician should be asked that's running for mayor is, are you going to implement stop and frisk laws in the city of Chicago? That's the problem.
Thanks for the call, Don. I mean, I think that's a tactic, but I don't know that that's transformational. I think part of this is civilian support for the police, generally speaking.
Right.
Go back to what Bratton did in New York City. Look at a model that's successful.
Yeah, the broken windows.
Right, in part, and also it was a big data play, too, there. It was outlined in a City Journal piece by Bratton a few weeks ago that's worth checking out. Defer to models that work. Why don't we? I don't know why we have to continue scaling and perpetuating models that have failed. Why don't we scale models that work? Police, what Bratton did in New York City. Schools, Tim King's Urban Prep Academies.
Yep.
Programming, youth-oriented programming, anti-violence programming, if you will. Midtown Education Foundation, what they do. Go check out the Glenwood School for Boys in South Cook County. Go check out Northridge Prep in Niles. There are models, successful models, weeds growing up through the sidewalk all over the city and Chicago metro area. So why don't we scale them instead of perpetuating these abject failures and the cost of the failures? And I'm not even talking about financially. Joe and McHenry.
Hello.
Yeah, Joe.
Yeah, Dan, listen, you know, the justice system in our system got to be straightened out. We got to untie the police hands and let them arrest these criminals, put them in the courts and whatever. But if they keep letting them out, it's not going to solve the problem for the crimes.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Right. That's the prosecution, the judges, you know, state's attorneys and judges. That's part of the conversation. No question. Steve and Niles.
Yeah, did any of the mayors ever mention their own values on the city?
Okay, thanks for the call, Steve. I mean, Rahm talked a lot about Chicago values. It was usually to describe what they're not. Chick-fil-A, not Chicago values. Shooting each other, not Chicago values. Well, I certainly agree with that on the second point, but you're right. It's always speaking in the negative. It's a weird way to talk about yourself, isn't it? Or talk about, do you talk about that way? Talk that way about, like, when somebody asks you, what does your kid do? He's not a drug dealer.
Well,
talk about your kid in the negative? Do you talk about what you do in the negative? What do you do for a living? I'm not a criminal. No, you say what you do. Say what your interests are. So, yes, some promotion of first principles, of values, if you will, in the positive in terms of what informs, not what doesn't inform. Bill on the north side.
Yeah, I just want to have everybody keep an eye on the police department, fire department. The meritorious promotions are going to start popping. All his buddies are going to get promoted so they get bigger pensions. Same with these inner garbage department, water department. All these people are going to start getting bumped up. That helped him over these, because now he doesn't have to worry about it. He's gone.
Yeah.
So he's going to say his goodbye by doing that to thank them with our money.
Spending our tax dollars.
Well, thanks for the call, Bill. Well, remember, you still got this $10 billion borrowing scheme on the table to try and stave off the capsizing of the police and fire pension funds, which are $30 billion underfunded. And they're circling the drain. That'll be another challenge for the next mayor, something that they should be asked about on the trail now. Sean in Elmwood Park.
Prof, it's the perfect pump and dump. You're looking at this all wrong, baby.
Yeah.
In order to cash out, you got to get out. Now the chickens are coming home to roost,
okay,
and you're going to get Jelly Belly Pritzker in there. You're going to get it. And what do you think is going to happen when it's the timing is impeccable. He's like the Wolf of Wall Street. You pumped it up. You got all your contracts in place. All the tax benefits have been cut. All the board memberships are lined up. It's the perfect exit. Nothing is what it looks like in the picture. It's what's behind the scenes. It is. I am so really I'm envious. The diabolical nature of the perfect pump and dump. Now, you mentioned about this, all the borrowing
schemes. First of all, this is not clever. This is not a Machiavellian foray. This is obvious.
Well, it is if you're getting checks every month.
Yeah, here's how it actually is going down, and it's obvious. So it's largely what you say. He lost popular support. He can't win. So now he goes out with a parachute he always had, which is to leverage his relationships with the Chicago financier class and his relationships in financial services around the globe to go make a boatload of money. Yeah, I know. That's no surprise.
And you avoid the Pritzker years. Pan out 2 years from now. You think things are bad now. You ain't seen nothing yet. You better get your Mad Max costume out when Pritzker gets in. All and right. As far as you, Amy, you don't Ready want new taxes?
No.
You don't want new taxes, Amy? You better leave. Don't even bother selling. Abandon the house. You'll be better off.
All right, John.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.